The following preview is of a graphic audio production rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Outlanders number 42, Satan's Seed. Nazi time travelers have overshot their destination and are intent on conquering the remains of the post-Nukost world. Among them is the so-called world's wickedest man.
Who the hell are you?
My name is Alistair Crowley.
Crowley?
You know me.
I know of you.
I am Countess Paula von Schicksal.
Sorry?
I take it that name is not familiar to you.
Afraid not.
But you recognize the name of a fat homosexual drug addict.
Wow, he was famous. Where are my friends?
The Nipponese and that colonial thug? They are right behind you.
Are you guys all right?
Hell no, we're not all right.
Why is a Nipponese in the company of two Americans?
Why shouldn't he be?
The Japanese are renowned for their long memories. I would not have thought they would ever forget about August 6th, 1945.
What happened then?
You mean you do not know?
Why should I? That was over 260 years ago.
The 200. Year. What year is this?
You're from the past. From World War II or thereabouts, aren't you?
The year and location.
The year is 2203.
How can that be? Lam said we would jump only a century ahead, when the Archons would be in control. That was the plan.
How did you get here?
You would not understand.
Does it have something to do with the Black Sun?
An away team led by Brewster Filboid keeps the Cerberus Warriors alive against all odds.
Something is happening.
As they return to Thunder Isle.
Move, you dumbass!
In Outlanders number 42, Satan's Seed.
And now, for our feature presentation. Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Previously in Deathstalker Destiny.
Hang them all. They're all politicians. All dirty.
Owen Deathstalker and Hazel Dark are missing. Presumed dead. Constance Wolfe will be marrying Robert Campbell instead.
Take us to Parliament. I have some things I want to say to them.
Okay. Nanoplane. Hopping its way from world to world, starting at the rim and heading inward. The only way to go so far, so fast, is if they teleported. Shub!
Jack Random's announced that he has something very important to say. He's gonna make a speech at his place, in the Parliament building.
What are you going to do, Random?
What can you do?
Just what I did on Loki. Punish the guilty. Kill all of those responsible for the corruption of my dream. Starting with everyone here in this room.
The Motto Mundi is nothing more than the collective unconsciousness of all espers. It has learned to exist separately from the individual thoughts and consciousness of the millions of espers that give it form.
But what about the leaders of the Esper Underground?
No Esper leaders. There never have been. They never were anything more than masks for the Motto Mundi to hide behind.
What the hell's the matter with you, Grace?
We are the eyes and ears of the rogue AIs of Shub.
Speaker of the House, I have automatic access to all political and military intelligence. All of it goes straight to Shub.
What happened to the real Grace Shrek?
I'm wearing all that's left of her.
Jack Random killed all these people. He has to be stopped.
You mean killed?
Parliament will authorize an extraordinarily high bounty for his head. Kill him, Ruby, if you can.
No problem.
They're back. The Recreated have finally come out of the dark to destroy us all. There's nothing I or the fleet can do to save you. Every species has to face its own extinction eventually.
Graphic Audio presents Simon R. Green's Deathstalker Destiny. Narrated and directed by Richard Rowan. With performances by Terrence Acil Ford, Nanette Savard, Colleen Delaney, David Coyne, Ann Flosnick, Nick Sampson, James Konacek, and Thomas Penny. Graphic audio sound design by Dan Smith. Episode 3, Even Legends Die. Everyone was summoned to attend Parliament, and everyone came, whether he or she wanted to or not. Armed guards accompanied the invitations, and they escorted the invited right to the doors of Parliament, just to make sure that they didn't get lost along the way and accidentally end up somewhere else. More than a few people arrived with bruises and bloody heads, but everyone sent for finally arrived on the floor of the House, crammed together into a very dissatisfied and loudly objecting crowd. Not least the members of Parliament, who weren't allowed to take their usual seats, but instead had to stand on the floor along with everyone else. The guards lined the walls, their guns trained unwaveringly on the crowd. MPs and movers and shakers from all levels of society, anyone who was anyone in all the many spheres of influence and intrigue, had been summoned, and only some of them suspected why. There were family members, industrial giants, clones, and espers, standing reluctantly shoulder to shoulder, united for once in their shared anger and confusion. Gradually, people became aware that the speaker's chair was empty, and there was no sign anywhere of Elias Gutman. Instead, Robert Campbell and Constance Wolfe stood on the raised dais, on either side of the empty chair. They looked calm and determined, as though waiting to carry out some unpleasant but necessary duty. And standing before the dais, those two most notable killers, Ruby Journey and Kit Summerisle, who gave every indication of looking forward to some unpleasant and excessively violent duty. When the last few summoned had been shoved onto the floor of the House by their guards, the main doors were closed and locked behind them. More guards appeared in the public galleries overhead, training energy and projectile weapons on the crowd below. Even more disturbing, 30 or 40 elves appeared in the galleries too, standing tall and arrogant in their battered leathers and gaudy colors, studying the crowd below with piercing eyes. Now and again, one would murmur something to a guard, who would nod and make a note. The tone of the crowd's raised voice changed slowly from anger to querulous unease. They'd seen such shows of force before, back in Lionstone's day, and such displays had always ended in bloodshed, sometimes on a grand scale. The times were supposed to have changed, and new laws were supposed to protect people from the old outrages, but looking at the many armed guards, it wasn't difficult to believe that someone in power still believed the old ways were best. Finally, Robert Campbell stepped forward. Even if it was bad news, everyone wanted to know what was coming, if only so they could start planning which way to duck and who else they could try and lay the blame on. Most of them trusted Robert to give it to them straight. He looked out over the assembled crowd, his face hard and cold.
You will have noticed that the speaker, Elias Gutman, is missing from his chair. He has been proven not just a traitor, but an enemy of humanity. Gutman was one of the dragon's teeth, his mind destroyed in the computer matrix. Shub looked out of his eyes and spoke with his mouth.
He paused a moment, as though expecting some comment or reaction, but the crowd just stared back at him, waiting for the other shoe to fall. They knew there had to be more, and it was going to be bad. Robert squared his shoulders.
Grace Schreck has been revealed as a fury and destroyed. From studying her records and Gutman's, we have determined that Shub has infiltrated all levels of authority and security on Golgotha. It has therefore been determined that everyone of substance should be brought here to be scanned by espers so we can be sure who is who and what is what.
Fists were shaken, and empty hands twitched unhappily at sides where swords and guns would normally have hung. No weapons had been allowed in the house this time. It wasn't that the crowd didn't believe what Robert had told them, or that they didn't appreciate the importance of what had been discovered. They just couldn't accept an Esper scan as the answer. Everyone has something they can't bear to have known, even to their closest and most loved ones. The crowd stirred this way and that, its anger building. But for the moment, they remained quelled by the many guns trained on them from all sides. Finally, two men pushed their way to the front of the crowd and glared up at the Campbell. Raj Peyton, Merchant Prince, was a large, square-built man with a history of cunning deals and hard bargaining. At his side stood the acerbic social columnist D. Langford, purveyor of unsuspected truths and assassin of reputations, whose pieces everyone read, if only to be sure they weren't in them.
Where the hell do you get off ordering us brought to Parliament like this, under armed guards and implied threats? Who gave you authority over us?
You did.
Constance Wolfe stepped forward to stand beside Robert Campbell.
You chose us to be the new monarchs of the Empire because you trusted us. Trust us now to do what is necessary for the good of humanity. After this is over, power will return to the members of Parliament, or at least to the remaining MPs.
She looked around her for challenges, but the crowd was quiet again, desperate for more information.
Who else could the uncoverers of this plot turn to but Robert and I? Particularly when it became clear that Parliament itself had been infiltrated by our enemies. The innocent have nothing to fear. The Espers have assured me that only the lightest of mental touches are necessary to determine if your thoughts are human or otherwise.
We only have your word for that. The Esper Underground could do much to increase its status and influence if it had access to our thoughts. We cannot put ourselves into the hands of potential blackmailers. What you ask is unacceptable, and we refuse.
Too late. We had all of Parliament's Esp blockers removed before you got here. The elves have been scanning you ever since you arrived, and have been determining who our real enemies are, even while you've been talking. The guards have been given their targets on a shielded comm channel. Death to the enemies of humanity!
And on that prearranged signal, sharpshooters among the guards in the galleries opened fire on their individual targets. Soft-nosed bullets took out the dragon's team, cutting down the merely human bodies with merciless accuracy. Energy blasts from disruptors punched holes through the concealed metal chests of Furies posing as men. There was mass panic as the guards opened fire. And inevitably, innocents were hurt or killed as they moved into the line of fire, or the targets grabbed them for use as shields. Battle espers among the elves worked to separate the guilty from the innocent, but as the crowd surged this way and that, screaming and jostling, it was hard for anyone to work out what was going on. Some tried to rush the locked doors, but there were guards waiting for that, and they grimly cut down anyone trying to leave the killing ground. Raj Peyton grabbed D. Langford and used him as a human shield as he charged toward Robert and Constance. Bullets slammed into Langford, but Peyton's more than human strength held him in place, soaking up punishment even after he was dead. An energy beam hit Peyton's head a glancing blow, ripping away half the human face to reveal the metal skull of a Fury below. He'd almost reached the unflinching Robert Campbell when Kit Summerisle stepped forward and casually shot out one of the Fury's knees. He crashed to the dais, losing his grip on his dead shield, and Ruby Journey shot him through the back, destroying the Fury's link with his shoved masters. And very soon, it was all over. Panic slowly died away, as it became clear the shooting had stopped, and was replaced by a numbed calm and acceptance. Guards moved among them, separating the condemned dead from the cleared living. There were a lot of bodies. Among them, members of Parliament, movers and shakers of industry, and some leaders of the Clone and Esper undergrounds. Robert had suspected that last, which was why he'd brought in elves to do his scanning for him. Their mass gestalt precluded traitors. A great many of the families had lost members too, unsuspecting men and women who'd entered the Matrix as humans and came out again as dragon's teeth. There were people weeping on all sides, and many were stumbling aimlessly around, blank-faced with shock. Everyone there had lost someone, or knew someone who had. Later, there would be recriminations, refusals to believe, and threats of revenge over the innocent fallen. But for now, it was mostly just grief that moved through the crowd, over friends and family murdered long ago by Shub so that their bodies could serve as traitors. And just when everyone thought the worst was over, a view screen formed in midair, showing General Beckett. He'd used his considerable authority to force contact, even past the current level of security. He glared out of the screen, standing on the bridge of his ship, the flagship of the Imperial fleet. Beside him stood half a man, browbeaten and bullied into joining the fleet, whether he wanted to or not. Everyone gave Beckett their full attention. They knew he wouldn't have interrupted unless this was vitally important. He and half a man had been placed in personal charge of the largest single section of the fleet left, and sent out to face Shub's fleet. But they shouldn't have made contact with the Shub vessels for days yet.
About time! Forget our damn security! This is urgent!
What is it, General? We're in the middle of a delicate situation right now.
The hell with your situation! The Recreated are here! They're only a week or so out from Golgotha. We might be able to slow them down some, but God knows for how long. Send every ship you've got to join us. Half the fleet's already gone. If you can, try and make a temporary deal with Shub and the Hatemen. The Recreated are their enemy too. Send more ships! The front line of the war is right here, right now!
What about you, Half a Man? You're supposed to be our expert on the Recreated. What do you suggest?
I don't understand any of this. I should know what to do, but when I look for it in my mind, it isn't there. Most of my mind isn't there. Memories are missing, and my thoughts slam up against walls I didn't even know were there. I don't think I'm who I thought I was. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. But I think I'm just the smile on the face of the tiger.
And the energy half of his body ate the human half, consuming the flesh inch by inch. His screams finally stopped, because there wasn't enough left of the lung to support them. The single eye stared mutely out of the half face until it too was gone. And then, there was only a spitting and crackling energy shape left on the bridge of the fleet's flagship. Its shape was nothing like a man. General Beckett drew his disruptor and shot the thing at point-blank range, but it had no effect. As he stood there helpless, a voice was heard, on the bridge and in Parliament.
We are the Recreated. We have left the dark. Destroy the light. It is our time. Come round at last. Our long-awaited revenge begins now.
The energy shape thrust its glowing hand into General Beckett's chest and ripped out his heart. And even as Beckett's body slumped to the bloody deck, the energy shape turned to the control panels and hit the emergency destruct. The view screen went black, and for a long moment, it was very quiet in Parliament. They might have got over the shock and started making some kind of decisions, but the worst wasn't over yet. There was a frenzied pounding on the closed and locked main doors from the other side. Heads slowly turned to look, and Robert gestured to the nearest guards to unlock the doors. They did so, and Toby Shrek came storming in, with Flynn at his heels.
We know who the carrier is for the nanoplague. The name was in Gutman's files. It's Daniel Wolf.
And Daniel Wolf, who had escaped detection by the Espers because he honestly didn't know he was a traitor, felt his face fall.
What? But wait.
And suddenly, all of Daniel's memories came crashing back, and he remembered his trip to Shub and what they had done to him there. He remembered his trips to all the other planets Shub had infected, and all the people he touched and unknowingly condemned to death.
My God! All those people! I can't! What have I done?
And even as he screamed his sanity away, deeply buried Shub programming took over and sent him running for the open doors, throwing people out of his way. Guards opened fire with bullets and energy blasts, but none of them stopped him. The nanotech within him repairing all his wounds instantly. In a moment, he was gone. Once upon a time, she was just an Esper named Diana Virtue. But things had become rather complicated since then. As Jenny Psycho, she'd been a hardcore terrorist and a saint of the Mater Mundi. But she'd outgrown both those roles. She'd gone looking for the truths of her existence, the meaning and purpose behind the events that had shaped her life. And unfortunately for her, she found them. Now she was just an Esper on the run, hiding out in what used to be Finley Campbell's old bolt hole, a single cramped apartment in the Warrens under the arenas. The place was a mess, but she couldn't seem to raise the strength of purpose to do anything about it. She lay on her back on the unmade bed, wearing dirty, sweat-stained clothes because she had nothing to change into, staring up at the ceiling above her, seeing everything and nothing. Her mental shields were all in place, as strong as she could make them. The most powerful Espers in the Empire could have walked past her door and not known she was there. Theoretically. Once Diana would have been sure, but there were a lot of things she wasn't sure about anymore. It helped that directly above her were the killing grounds of the arenas, where the dying never stopped. The endless flow of suffering and slaughter, and the raging emotions and bloodlust of the watching crowds, set up a constant mental bedlam that no one should be able to detect anything through. Diana was as safe and hidden as it was possible for anyone to be. And none of that mattered a damn, because she was hiding from the Mater Mundi. It would find her eventually, if only through the process of elimination. There were only so many places on Golgotha where you could hope to hide from a determined telepath. With millions of minds to search with, the Mater Mundi would track her down in time. And then Diana would have to run again, or stand and fight. Either choice seemed likely to end in her death. Diana Virtue laced her fingers across her stomach and wondered what the hell she was going to do next. How had her life come to this? A fugitive in a dirty room, contemplating her own imminent death. She'd had such plans when she was younger, such fervent hopes and great intentions. All the wondrous things she was going to do. Of course, she'd had a lot of the fire and innocence knocked out of her on the ghost world Unseelie, used as bait to catch a monster by her own father, menaced and driven to the point of madness, and only saved at the last by the Song of the Dead Ashrai. She was never the same afterward. As soon as her father's old ship, the Darkwind, had docked at Golgotha, she deserted the Navy and went underground, joining the Espers rebelling against Imperial authority. She thought she'd found friends and allies there and a cause to believe in. But in the end, they just used her too. They hid her thoughts behind a fake personality called Jenny Psycho, and then allowed her to be captured and sent to the Esper prison Silo 9, also known as Wormboy Hell. And then the Mater Mundi manifested through her, giving her the power to free herself and the other Esper prisoners. Diana thought she'd finally found her role. She embraced the Jenny Psycho persona and allowed other Espers to declare her a living saint of our Mother of All Souls. But that turned out to be a lie too, when the Mater Mundi abandoned her on Mistworld, just when Diana needed her most. She should have known. She should have expected it. The one continuing factor of her young life had always been betrayal. Then the Great Rebellion, the overthrowing of Lionstone, and a chance for a new life for all Espers. So Diana put the Jenny Psycho persona behind her, and tried to create a new role for herself, only to face the greatest betrayal of all. The new order turned out to be just as corrupt as the old, only more subtle. The new freedom for Espers included the freedom to starve and die and be forgotten. And the Esper Underground, that great force for justice and the good, turned out to be an unknowing tool of its own subconscious. The last and greatest betrayal, that the cause to which she'd given her life had proved to be nothing but a mask for the same kind of heartless manipulation she'd been fighting. Diana idly wondered why she clung so grimly to a life that had brought her only disappointment and the destruction of her beliefs. Perhaps she continued just to spite the fates that seemed so determined to grind her down. There was a strong, stubborn streak in Diana that would not yield to any outside pressure, no matter how great. Perhaps the only useful thing she'd inherited from her illustrious father. She was damned if she'd just give up and die, if only to frustrate the Mater Mundi one more time. She smiled widely at the ceiling above her, a thin-lipped snarl that had only the blackest of humor in it. Diana Virtue or Jenny Psycho, or whoever the hell she really was at heart, had always been a fighter. Once more into the breach, into the Valley of Death, into darkness and damnation if necessary, just for a chance to drag her enemy down with her. It occurred to her then, in something very like an epiphany, that she wasn't necessarily alone in this fight. There were others like her, powerful minds unconnected to the Mater Mundi, that might yet be convinced to fight beside her. She reached out with her altered, expanded mind, in directions only she could sense, sending out a call for help that only minds like hers could hear, let alone respond to. Confuse and confound the searching Mater Mundi, Diana sent her mind shooting up and out of her body, up past the bloody sands of the arenas, up and beyond the Parade of the Endless, until finally Golgotha itself lay turning slowly beneath her. The world looked very vulnerable, all alone in the dark. Some way off in the distance, but drawing slowly closer all the time, was the Recreated. A great howling black hole, trying to suck her thoughts and her soul into its awful inhuman self. But it was still too far away to be able to compel her, and Diana turned her mental back on it, secure behind her shields.
Hear me, those who can. Is anyone there?
To her great surprise, the first response came from a dead man.
Hi, what's up?
Owen, you're supposed to be dead. No one's been able to contact you or find any trace of you for ages.
Sorry to disappoint you, but we've been kind of busy.
The mind boggles at what?
We've just finished wiping out the Bloodrunners. They'd used a rather unusual power source to recreate their own subspace dimension. A private little reality of their own where they could concentrate on torture and murder undisturbed. But I found a way in. Now the subspace, the homeworld, and the Bloodrunners no longer exist.
We kicked their ass.
Well, thank the good God you're back. Because I've got an enemy here that could seriously use a good kicking, and I can't do it alone.
Hold everything. I'm sorry to disappoint you, but Hazel and I have our own mission now we're back, and we can't afford to be distracted. We have to go back into the Dark Void, back to the Wolfling world. Something's happened there, something bad. Something only we can deal with.
Whatever it is, it can wait. A lot's happened while you were out of touch. Most of it really bad.
Department of absolutely no surprise there. We take our eye off the ball for 5 minutes and everything goes to hell.
What's happened about the royal wedding? I mean, if everyone thinks I'm dead...
It's still going ahead. Only Constance is marrying Robert Campbell instead.
Ah. All for the best, really, I suppose. The Campbell's a good man. Probably make a much better constitutional monarch, too. I never wanted to be emperor.
How does Constance feel about all this?
Oh, it's a love match this time. It's really very sweet. But can we not be distracted, please? The whole existence of humanity is under threat. You've got to come back.
She broadcast compressed telepathic images of all that had been happening during Owen and Hazel's absence. The great golden ships of the Hayden Men blasting the fleet apart, destroying cities on 100 worlds, deploying armies of golden-eyed, merciless killers to destroy or remake humanity in their own logical image. The huge shove ships sailing out of the Forbidden Sector in endless numbers, taking planet after planet with their armies of Furies and Ghost Warriors and Grendel aliens. The Recreated, and their vast insane ships, moving steadily toward the homeworld Golgotha. The Nanoplague, spreading slowly but unstoppably from world to world, melting down all living tissue. Jack Random executing his enemies on Loki, and then returning to Golgotha to murder more people there, before going on the run with Ruby Journey in hot pursuit, sworn to kill him. And finally, the awful truth about the actual nature of the Mater Mundi.
Damn. I can't believe Jack's gone rogue.
I fought on Loki as a mercenary some time back. Probably besides some of the same people Jack had hanged. A bloody rebellion and a worse peace.
I just can't believe Jack just killed that many people in cold blood.
Oh, you can be pretty sure it wasn't cold blood. By all accounts, he had a really good time doing it.
Something must have pushed him over the edge. Jack was a good man, a hero. He must have lost his mind.
And a madman with your powers and abilities could do a hell of a lot of damage. God knows how many more he'll kill before he stopped. Now, will you come back?
I've been trying to reach Jack through our old mental link. I can't get any response from him or Ruby. They must be deliberately blocking us out. We'd be no better at tracking him down than anyone else. And even if we could find him, I'm not sure what we'd do, what we could do. I mean, this is Jack Random we're talking about.
No one's above the law. It has to apply equally, or it means nothing. But Jack isn't our problem. None of the things you've described are as important as what's happening on the Wolfling world. Our mission there has to take precedence.
Captain Silence is on his way into the Dark Void. Let my father deal with it, whatever it is.
I don't think so. In fact, if he's on his way there, it's more important than ever that we get there first.
And as suddenly as that, they were gone.
Deathstalker! Hazel Dark! Answer me, goddammit! Shit!
Diana moved reluctantly on to the next on her mental list. Having located two maze mines, it wasn't too difficult for her to track down another.
Damn. I would have sworn no one could find me. Hello, Diana Virtue. How are you?
Just a tad desperate. How are you, Jack? Killed any more innocents recently?
None of them were innocent. They all needed killing. I'm just doing what I've always done. Taking out the garbage.
Diana tried to get a glimpse of where he was, or what he was planning, but Jack's shields were already reforming, like bricks in a great wall, and she knew he'd never let her find him again. She'd caught him by surprise, but her expanded mind, powerful as it was no match for his, and they both knew it. She quickly filled him in on the latest emergencies and the true nature of the Mater Mundi, but she could tell she wasn't reaching him.
Well, that's all very interesting, but Esper problems are your province, not mine. I have my own responsibilities, and the duty I have chosen to shoulder is a heavy one. I can't put it down, even for a moment. Don't try to find me again for your own sake. I can't trust anyone these days.
And then his presence was gone, shut away behind shields so powerful, Diana couldn't even sense where he had been.
Jack! Jack!
Diana, where is he?
Diana was somewhat surprised to hear from Ruby Journey. Hers was a cold, controlled presence, her thoughts as precise and unemotional as well-oiled machinery. Diana quickly prepared her own shields and defenses, just in case. This was Ruby Journey, after all.
I heard your call. I even managed to listen in on your conversation with Jack. I don't give a damn about your problems either. All I care about is locating Jack. You must have picked up some idea as to where he is. Some clue to what he's planning. Open your mind to me so I can see.
Go to hell. I'm not having you trampling about in my mind. I don't know where Jack is or what he intends to do, and if you're not willing to help me, I don't give a damn about you either. Foolish. Very foolish.
Her mind smashed against Diana's, but even her maze-given powers couldn't just sweep aside Diana's shields. Ruby increased the pressure, but despite the pain and the strain, Diana wouldn't give way. Ruby's power raged about her, like a storm that might capsize a ship at any moment, but somehow Diana's shield still held. And in the end, Ruby got tired, or bored, and backed off. She sent out a single mental image, and Diana studied it cautiously from behind her shields. The image showed Ruby Journey at a city armory, equipping herself with all manner of weapons and explosives, enough to hunt down and kill 100 men. Ruby was smiling coldly.
If Jack contacts you again, show him this image. Show him what's coming after him. And remind him that I never, ever stop once I've accepted a commission.
Ruby disappeared behind her shields and was gone, leaving Diana hovering alone above Golgotha. It was an unnerving thing to know you just faced an enemy that could have beaten you if she'd cared enough to spend a little more time and energy. Far off in the dark, she could feel the recreated, reaching out to everything. Diana felt very tired and very vulnerable, and fell back into her body. Once again, she was lying on her back on a stranger's bed, staring up at a dirty ceiling in search of answers it didn't have. There were others Diana could have tried to contact, but after her disappointments with the maze people, she couldn't see any point in exhausting herself any further. She was going to need her strength where she was going.
All right. I'll just have to do it alone. I've always had to do the most important things of my life alone.
She allowed herself a few moments to say goodbye to her life. She'd always hoped it would amount to something more than just a mistaken saint and a hero of the rebellion that most people seemed to prefer not to remember. Oh, they'd written her into a few of the Hollow films they'd made about the rebellion and its heroes, but she didn't recognize herself at all in the enigmatic sorceress or total psychopath they'd chosen to portray her as. Some accounts weren't even sure which side she'd fought on. But then, Jenny Psycho had always been a little too extreme for most tastes. She would have liked to have known love, friends, family, but there was never any time. She knew duty, and sometimes honor, but few friends, and never a love or a lover. She scared people. She gave so much to the cause, only to discover in the end that it wasn't worthy of her dedication. At least the elves had put up a statue to her. So, time to face down the impossible, master the monster, put her life and sanity on the line, as she had so many times before. Alone again against a powerful enemy, while those who might have helped her went their own way. Business as usual for Diana Virtue. She summoned up all the old berserker rage and dedication of her Jenny Psycho persona and dove deep into her own mind, down past the shining columns of conscious thought and into the dark, unexplored areas of the mind, the back brain. Some joking part of herself showed her a bright neon sign, "Abandon hope, O ye who enter here." And then she'd left the outside reality behind, diving down into the dark miracles and mysteries of the inner mind, the face behind the mask, the place where normal humans couldn't go, the back brain. Most people didn't know what the back brain was, though a few bandied the name about as though they did. Most people only used a small part of their brain, accessing only the merest fraction of what it could do. The Esper gene allowed some people to delve deeper into their minds than most and make use of the powers they found there. Telepathy, pyrokinesis, precognition. Others, like the Maze people who'd had their minds forced open by outside forces, could call up even stranger and wondrous abilities. Diana had studied the concept of the back brain during her time in the Esper Guildhouse, trawling tirelessly through its massive files in search of knowledge. The Espers had been studying themselves almost as long as they had existed, and they had discovered many things about who and what they were, most of it disturbing. Most of that knowledge had never been released, even inside the Esper community, and much was actively suppressed, for a variety of reasons. Partly because if the normals ever got hold of it, they'd just use it to better control their Esper slaves. And partly because the Mater Mundi made sure some things were forgotten, rather than risk their true nature being exposed. Perhaps the greatest secret of all was that the human mind was capable of far more than either normals or Espers ever dreamed of. Anyone could become like the Maze people if they could only access and control the secrets of the back brain. All that gray matter and potential that was never used. Diana had written it all down and hidden it in a file that couldn't easily be found, so that if the Mater Mundi did win in the end, and Diana Virtue disappeared, never to be seen or spoken of again, what she'd learned might still survive. "We could all shine like suns," she wrote. She still believed that. Even after all the horrors and tragedies she'd seen, she still believed. She passed through the back brain and on into the undermind. Few people knew about the back brain, fewer still knew about the undermind. Mainly because you could only reach the undermind through the back brain. It was a vast, awful, magnificent place, and not everyone survived encountering it. The undermind was the collective unconscious of all humanity. The dream time, the race memory, the bedrock of human existence. As far as Diana knew, the undermind had no distinct persona or agenda, like the Mater Mundi. It simply existed, the place that was not a place, where all minds came together, the great dreaming unconscious from which all human thought derived. Or perhaps it wasn't any of those things. Diana was only an explorer in these regions, and what she saw was filtered through her own conscious mind. She saw the collective unconscious as a great ocean, the sea of dreams, the waters we all swim in for 9 months before we're born, the place we visit for dreams and ideas and inspiration. An ocean big as the world, greater than all the worlds. Diana had to be careful how she thought about it. Her mind was interpreting what was there in terms she could deal with. Allow her mind to drift beyond that, and she'd lose whatever control over the situation she had. She could become lost forever here, mislaid, swept away by unknown tides, her thoughts drifting forever as a screaming phantom in other people's dreams. This was a place with no maps, no boundaries, and no limitations. Here be tigers. She was standing on a small island, a rock-hard place of conscious intent and certainty. Waves lapped slowly against it. She'd manifested in her old Jenny Psycho form, complete with spiked steel armor and a gun so huge she couldn't have lifted it in the waking world. The gun represented her power. She hoped she wouldn't have to use it. There were shadows and colors in the sky, streaming overhead like the nightmares rainbows might have. These were stray thoughts, coming and going in people's heads. Sometimes the colors became recognizable shapes and images, representing things that troubled or intrigued humanity's thoughts. The rocky reefs of the zeitgeist. Looking at them made Diana's head hurt, so instead she looked down into the tranquil waters surrounding her island. There were things there, too, vast shapes moving slowly through the dream waters. The shared ideas, beliefs, and compulsions of human culture. People created them and spread them, and then they had power over people. Things are in the saddle and ride mankind, but we put the bit between our teeth. Humanity's collective unconscious. They called it the world mind before we went to the stars and spread ourselves over so many worlds. You could go fishing in the sea of dreams and pull out anything, anything at all. The collective unconscious is full of archetypes, perfect manifestations of cultural tropes or fascinations. The wise old man, the mystical virgin, the king with a wound that will not heal. You could have interesting conversations with them, as long as you realized their words only made sense in the world of dreams and fancies. Their truths were too great for the waking world. And since this was the Sea of Dreams, there were bad things here too. Horrors of the kind that can only exist in nightmares. Everyone knows that there are things in dreams that will get you unless you wake up first. And in the Undermind, there is no waking up. Those few, very few people who have any knowledge of the Undermind wonder if perhaps these things are the natural predators of this place. Or are they rather just externalized manifestations of the psychic mindset, self-loathing, depression, homicidal manias? Diana didn't know. She had visited the Undermind just often enough to know it was larger and more complex than the conscious mind could deal with, except in very short doses. Diana decided that her thoughts were starting to get out of hand and clamped down hard. In the sea of dreams, even the vaguest of thoughts can have repercussions. She made herself concentrate and looked around for her enemies. This was the human collective unconscious, but there were others who could come here too, as if in some strange way they belonged here. High up in the colorless sky hung a gray, watchful presence. That was the rogue eyes of Shub. They had no subconscious, but sheer mental power gave them a window into the Undermind, through which they watched and cogitated and failed to understand. Shub did not dream. There was a silvery moon overhead that shone only faintly with its own light and reflected in the waters. That was the Haydenman Collective. They didn't understand the Undermind either, but all their science had not been enough to stop them dreaming. Most baleful of all, there was a sun in the Undermind sky, a black sun. That was the Recreated. Diana had no idea what they were doing here, but just looking at the black sun scared the shit out of her, so quite sensibly, she stopped looking at it. Instead, she looked out across her little island, her rock of certainty, and saw the air ripple before her like a heat haze. Visitors were coming, and in a moment, there they were. Thought of by most as the leaders of the Esper Underground, but actually archetypes thrown up by the Esper Collective Unconscious. There was a waterfall cascading endlessly down out of nowhere, with two great shadows that might have been eyes. A swirling mandala of clashing colors hung unsupported in the air, forever growing and swallowing itself at the same time. A 20-foot dragon curled its golden scales around a tree. a muscular human form, nude and exaggerated, usually known as Mr. Perfect. A huge hog with blood-stained tusks and tiny crimson eyes, covered with tattoos of ancient runes and sigils. A 10-foot-tall woman wrapped in shimmering light with a cratered moon for a face. All of them aspects of the Mater Mundi, given shape and form to rule over the Espers.
You should not have come here. This is our place, where we are strongest, and you are alone. You must die, that we might live. We made you stronger than we intended, but here and now, we will undo that mistake. We are the dark, deep thoughts of Vesper kind, and the future belongs to us.
Not necessarily. Let's see if I really am alone in this fight.
She extended her foot past the edge of her island and thrust the toe of her boot into the ocean. Ripples spread slowly out across the surface of the ocean, just like those caused by a pebble dropped into a pond. The ripples increased their speed until they were shooting across the surface of the Sea of Dreams, more and more of them all the time. The Mater Mundi archetypes stirred silently. There was a feeling of pressure, of imminence on the air, of something about to happen. And in a moment, Diana was no longer alone. Drawn by her silent call for help, by a voice that spoke in their dreams and would not be denied, her friends and allies came to her. First was Investigator Topaz of Mistworld, standing before Diana in silver plate armor, chased with hoarfrost. Her face was deathly white, and her hair was thick swirls of ice. The long sword in her hand steamed coldly. The Snow Queen, the Ice Princess, the unrelenting cold that can break the hardest spirit, shatter the strongest metal. Topaz had also once been a manifest of the Mater Mundi, but like Diana, had broken free to become her own person. She looked expressionlessly at the archetypes grouped together at the other end of the island, and then turned her icy gaze on Diana.
What am I doing here? Am I dreaming? I remember lying down to sleep.
This is where you go when you dream, but what happens here is real enough. Events here have repercussions in the waking world. The freak show over there represents the Mater Mundi. They want to kill us and enslave all humanity. Will you stand with me against them?
The investigator smiled, revealing teeth as white as frost.
Have you ever known me to back away from a good fight? I can feel the danger here, Virtue. I can feel the stakes and what we're fighting for. But there'd better be a few more of us, or it's going to be a short and very one-sided fight.
Don't worry. The Sea of Dreams reaches everywhere. Others will have heard my call.
And one by one, appearing out of nowhere, dropping through the dreaming into the Undermind, came others who had fought the good fight for humanity's soul. Others who were no strangers to the Backbrain and the power to be found there. One by one they came to the island, in the image they had of themselves. Typhoid Mary rose up out of the ground with a dead face and sorrowful eyes, clothed in a rafting shroud and dirty grave wrappings. Skulls of dead children hung from her belt, and her hands dripped blood. But her heart shone pure, and she burned with the need for atonement. Next came Tobias Moon, striding up out of the waters and onto the island, smiling gently. All a man now, with nothing of the Haydenman left in him. Scarlet foliage curled around him, alive and aware. Captain Silence and the traitor called Carrion arrived together out of nowhere. Silence wore a suit of old-fashioned armor, scoured with rust, and bore a shield whose design had been mostly worn away. He looked older than he usually did, and his eyes were tired and sad. Carrion looked exactly as he always did. He knew what he was. A long, slender chain ran from his wrist to Silence's. And finally, hovering above them, standing calmly in midair as though it didn't need the illusion of solid ground, the elf Gestalt. A city full of minds, personified in the single figure they admired the most. In all her familiar leathers and chains and colors, Stevie Blue. A power began to build within and around them, cloaking them in a strength and dominion they could never have raised separately. Their shared intent crackled in the air among them, sharp and potent. But even so, they all knew that their combined will wasn't going to be enough to stand against the collective unconscious of all the Espers in the Empire. Diana looked about her, at all the people touched by forces greater than themselves, altered beyond the limitations of mere humanity, and knew with sinking heart that some odds were just too great to be beaten. To buy time, she addressed the Mater Mundi archetypes directly.
Why did you bother choosing manifests for your power? Why transform people you expected to go insane and die?
They were our means for direct action on the physical plane. And they were our home. Our attempt to create more powerful espers. To be our weapons against those who would oppress us. And deny us our destiny. Espers must rule. We are naturally superior. We will replace and supersede poor, deaf, and dumb humanity. We were content to work slowly until your friends passed through the madness maze and threatened to become greater than we. They are not like us. They could become greater than we are. We cannot allow that. Our manifests failed before because their minds were too controlled, too rigid to embrace the power we granted. Now we know to choose minds that are more malleable. People like you and Topaz. With what we have learned from you, we will create an army of manifests. To carry out our will in the physical world. After we have destroyed you. All of you who dared to threaten our power. That was why we allowed you to call for help. We wanted you all here.
In this place.
So that you could be destroyed forever.
Out on the surface of the waters, a storm was brewing, the rage of the Mater Mundi. It grew and grew, sucking up the waters of the Sea of Dreams into a great dark tidal wave, hundreds of feet high, bearing inexorably down on Diana's tiny island. And everyone there knew that if that storm swept them away, they would drown in the ocean, lost forever in the Sea of Dreams. Their bodies, lying untenanted, would continue for as long as others cared to maintain them, but their souls would only exist in dreams. Diana and her companions raised their combined will and stopped the tidal wave in its tracks. It hung before them, a great wall of churning water, pressing against their minds, heavy and overpowering with the weight of all the Espers in the Empire unknowingly behind it. Foot by foot it surged forward, gradually building momentum despite their best efforts, and nothing Diana or her companions could do even slowed its inexorable advance. And that was when the four maze survivors finally chose to make their appearance. Owen, Hazel, Jack, and Ruby, standing at their ease at Diana's side. They all looked exactly as they normally did. They had no problems with self-image, and precious few illusions they could still hide behind. Owen Deathstalker smiled warmly at Diana, and then turned his attention on the Mater Mundi archetypes.
You didn't really think you could hide something as big as this from us, did you? Even we can take a hint if it shouted in our ears loudly enough. We have for the moment put aside our individual differences to deal with you. To start with, let's get rid of the storm.
The maze people turned their gaze on the tidal wave, and it collapsed back into the ocean and was gone. The Sea of Dreams was still and tranquil again. The maze people looked back at the archetypes, who stood their ground. Power was developing around Diana's island. And everyone there could feel it, a great charge building and building that would have to earth itself somewhere.
You cannot harm us. You dare not. Destroy us and you kill millions of Espers all across the Empire.
They're right. The Mater Mundi is an unconscious gestalt. The Espers honestly don't know what they've been doing.
Well then, you'll just have to send them a wake-up call.
The four maze minds slid effortlessly together, like interlocking pieces of a single puzzle, fusing into a single will far greater than anything they had ever achieved separately. Diana and her companions were swept up into it, a small but vital part carried along by the sheer power being wielded. The Mater Mundi archetypes raised their joint voice in a horrified scream as they realized what their enemy intended. They struck out with all their power, and it glanced harmlessly away. No match for the greater energies of more than human minds. That united will spoke in a voice that could not be ignored, thundering through all the Undermind, saying to every Esper on every world in the Empire,
"Wake up!"
And they did. In that moment, every Esper everywhere became aware of the Mater Mundi, what it was, and what it had done. They understood and forgave. And with an instant, sane, and compassionate decision, the Espers enveloped the Mater Mundi and superseded it to become a single, completely conscious Gestalt mind. Conscious, awake, and aware, and determined to put things right. The Mater Mundi archetypes snapped out of existence, no longer needed or tolerated, replaced by a single figure that was both male and female, shining so brightly it would have blinded a normal human being. The concerted will that had opposed it broke apart, and everyone was back in his or her own head again.
The Mater Mundi is no more. We have moved beyond that.
Good. So what will you do now?
We are not sure, but you've given us a lot to think about. You, all of you, have done so much for us, but we can do nothing for you. You cannot ever be a part of what we have become. You've progressed too far in different directions. You are no longer merely Espers.
Ah, hell. I've always been my own person.
The Gestalt figure vanished, and everyone relaxed a little. Investigator Topaz looked somewhat disappointed.
Typical. We can bring our people to the Promised Land, but... ah, well. Time to go, I think. If you've quite finished with us, Virtue, some of us have got jobs to go to when we wake up.
And one by one they disappeared, going back to their own lives in the waking world, until only Diana and the four maze people were left on her tiny island.
Well, that was interesting. Maybe someday all humanity will be part of some great gestalt, united by the backbrain and the undermind. Maybe someday, all life...
maybe. Owen looked out over the ocean.
This is a very restful place. I always knew it was here, but I never got around to visiting. Always something that needed doing. You know how it is. But there are possibilities here.
Right. I get the feeling the Sea of Dreams is separate from time. All times are one here. Past, present, and future are just directions, as far as dreams are concerned. Maybe my passing through this place explains the dreams I've been having. I have a plan to defeat Shub. It came to me suddenly, just now. This is the place of inspiration, after all. I'm going to need your old family standing, Sir Deathstalker.
My castle? It's yours. But don't ask us to help. Hazel and I still need to go back into the Dark Void.
And Ruby and I have unfinished business. Maybe afterwards.
Yes. Maybe afterwards.
They shared a brief smile, and then the maze figures were gone.
So, once more alone against impossible odds. But this time, I have a plan.
And then, she woke up. The mighty human empire had spread its seed across hundreds of worlds for hundreds of years, great and glorious, bestriding the scattered stars like a colossus. Its power and influence had shaped the destinies of both human and alien species, and many species that had dared to stand against the expanding empire no longer existed. And now, after all these hundreds of years, humanity was reaping what it had sown. There was nowhere and no one they could turn to for help. The Empire's sundered worlds were under attack from all sides at once, with what remained of their armies up against forces almost too large for human minds to grasp. The nightmare steel vessels of Shub, the huge golden ships of the Hayden Men, the awful dark presence of the recreated. Humanity had its back to the wall, and everyone could see the vultures gathering. The recreated descended implacably on the homeworld Golgotha from one direction, while the Shub fleet closed in from another. The two great boogeymen of human history had finally come calling, and the barricades stood largely unmanned. The ragged remains of the Imperial fleet were scattered across the Empire, fighting doggedly against impossible odds, while great armies fought to the death on the worlds below, no quarter asked or given. Ghost warriors, Furies, Grendels, and insect aliens stormed humanity's last redoubts, where men, women, and children fought with desperate courage for their species' survival. Humanity might be going down, but it was going down fighting. The nanoplague was everywhere now, springing up on planet after planet. There were quarantines and forbidden zones and draconian health regulations, and none of them did a damned bit of good. There were no warning signs, no anticipatory symptoms, nothing that could be guarded against or fought. Infected people watched in horror as their bodies suddenly mutated and transformed, their genetic code being rewritten from the inside. Grotesque and awful shapes lurched through the streets of human cities, killing and feeding and pleading for help, before they finally succumbed to the inevitable final stage of the plague, meltdown. Many tried suicide or called for mercy killings, but the nanotech within them remorselessly kept them alive until the final nightmarish end. Great gray rivers of undifferentiated goo swept slowly through silent and deserted human cities. Shub had always understood the effectiveness of terror weapons. There was mass rioting everywhere as law and order and social structures broke down. Looting became epidemic as supplies grew scarce and distribution became increasingly haphazard, and people grew tired of queuing for hours outside stores with mostly empty shelves. Panic spread faster than the plague. Religious crazies came bursting out of the woodwork, like rats joining a sinking ship, prophesying doom and destruction, and the end of all things. According to them, all kinds of messiahs were on their way, but somehow always tomorrow, never right now. The revealing of Shub agents in high positions had only boosted the already general air of paranoia. People no longer trusted one another, even when it was clearly vital that they had to work together for survival. All it took was a shouted accusation, and a mob could form in seconds, chasing suspected Shub agents to their deaths. Guards patrolled the streets in large groups, backed by merciless laws and powers of a type not seen since Lionstone's last days. They maintained a kind of peace, even if it was often only the peace of the newly dead. The media ran little but news channels, often 24 hours a day. The public was desperate for information, and even bad news was better than the nightmares their imaginations conjured up when there was no news. Live broadcasting dominated, mostly because things were happening too fast now for reflection or in-depth study. The only ray of hope left in the Empire was the forthcoming royal wedding on Golgotha. Parliament made sure the preparations got extensive coverage. It was the only thing left that still distracted people. The public had lost its faith in heroes. Jack Random had gone crazy, and when Deathstalker and Hazel Dark were missing, presumed dead, and no one had ever trusted Ruby Journey anyway. And the one they'd loved the most, the daredevil Esper hero Julian Skye, had died in a suicide pact with his love, Bibi Chojiro. His Hollow Show was still popular, though. Fans held candlelight vigils outside his old family house, declaring fervently that their hero would return to save them all, just when things seemed darkest. Some legends never run out of steam. The hunt was still on for Daniel Wolfe, the nano-carrier, public enemy number one. There was no trace of him anywhere, which should have been impossible. No human on any world would aid or hide him now, for any amount of money. People would burn down the houses of anyone even suspected of hiding him. But those few cool heads remaining remembered Shub's teleport facilities. Daniel Wolfe could be anywhere, anywhere at all. When the second and traitorous half-a-man murdered General Beckett and blew up his flagship, that effectively put an end to the Imperial Navy as a single force. Both Army and Navy had respected Beckett and followed wherever he led.
Now, any number of officers were competing for the vital position, and factions tore what was left of the fleet apart, producing only confusion and anarchy. There was no overall game plan anymore. Increasingly now, each planet and each ship fought alone, protecting its own. Parliament issued increasingly hysterical orders and was ignored by everyone. Now, Golgotha stood alone, the home world of humanity left effectively unprotected, while Shub and the Recreated raced to see which would get there first. Maybe it was the end of all things, after all.